What is going on, everybody? And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And of course, like I talk about every week, as always, except this time you can kind of get a look at him if you're here on YouTube, my amigo, Mr. Filio Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in studio. Glad it's been a while since we did a live stream. I know this isn't live, but at least you get to see the way we do the show.
Yeah.
It's not as spectacular as you might imagine.
Sadly,
it's basically us just sitting here with some laptops or iPads and reading and doing the research that we've already done prior to the episode. But no, I'm glad to be here, man. Dallas Stars have earned their way to the Stanley Cup final.
Right. Here we go.
It's what's crazy is living right here outside of Dallas-Fort Worth, it's hardly even talked about. All they want to talk about is the Cowboys. I'm not a huge football fan myself, so. But I'm proud. I'm excited about that. We got a trip coming up, to East Texas. We're going to go camping in October. I don't remember the exact date. I don't remember why the kids are out of school, but they're out of school for a couple days. So I'm looking forward to that.
Some squatching coming up? You know you're going to have to do some hiking around.
Yeah, of course I'll look around.
Yeah.
Anytime I'm in East Texas, you know, it does start to come into your mind like, wow, this is where a lot of the sightings have taken place. But yeah, no, I'm getting excited about that. I'm glad the kids are back in school. They're acclimating well. The coronavirus, there hasn't been anybody catching it really. I think a couple kids, and then they were quarantined and sent home. But nothing major. In fact, it's going so well that here in our small town, I think that there more and more kids are leaving homeschool and going back to the actual school because they gave us the ability to choose.
Yeah, like which one did
change
you want to do?
Time. Yeah. So we wanted them out of the house, so we shipped them right into school. And yeah, and it's going great. So.
You know what I liked about every time when we always go over to East Texas, and of course I can't speak on all these other places, but a lot of those little small towns have kind of embraced the idea of Bigfoot.
Yeah.
So you have like gift shops and big cutouts and paintings and all this stuff of Bigfoot there. So that's what makes it fun. And the reason, of course, we're bringing up Bigfoot is because we have Micah and Smokey and Jeff from Sasquatch Tracks.
That's right.
That are going to come on and they're going to talk about their whole podcast. And it was just fun getting to chat with him. And it's always fun to catch up with Micah.
That's right. And on the last episode, we mentioned the new phone number.
Yep.
If you have a sighting or story you'd like to share with me and Cam and you don't feel like writing it or typing it up, you can always just call the show and leave the story. We got a pretty interesting one right off the bat from a woman named April. And she has a strange fae sighting from when she was a little kid. Let's listen to that.
Let's do this.
Hey, guys. Fae story for you. My name's April. I grew up in southern Illinois, and this happened at my grandparents' house in the early 80s. They lived in a small town called Bluford, Illinois. Very small population, maybe 200 people, not very big. So my grandpa and grandma had a farm out there, cows. My parents lived a little ways away, and then they would go and take me and drop me off there, and we'd play with my cousins, spend the night, spend the weekend, whatever, you know, at the farm. We all played outside. It was the 80s and stuff, so, you know, it was a really cool experience. Their house was, it was a little creepy, a little, you know, the old barns and stuff, there's pasture, there was woods, you know, but their house was always a little bit creepy. There was always something kind of odd about it anyway. But, and I was real little when this happened. My grandpa always slept on the floor in the living room. It's just something he always did. Grandma slept in her bedroom, and in her bedroom, there was her bed, and at the foot of the bed, it was about 5 feet, and then there was a big closet, wall of closet there. Right in front of that was a crib. Now, I was still small enough to fit in that crib, but I remember this just like it was yesterday. I was asleep, and I was facing towards my grandma with my back to the closet, and in between the crib and the closet was like a space about 3 foot or so, and I remember waking up, turning over, and there was a little guy standing there. Well, he wasn't standing. He was in a little car. That sounds really crazy and out there. But anyway, I turned over and towards the closet, and I look out, and there is a little guy in a car. he's pulled up right beside my crib. And he reaches in and he takes my left hand and pulls it out through the crib little thing and kisses the top of my hand and then drives off into the wall, gone. And at that point, I freaked out, started crying for my grandma, and she got me and put me in bed and told me it was okay, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, fast forward a few years, I never left me. I always remembered that experience. And we would see some kind of weird things there, like shadows or white lights at the house and stuff, seeing my cousins. But I asked my grandma years later if she ever saw anything weird in that house, and she said, oh, do you mean like the little man that drives the stagecoach past my door and then laughed? And I don't know if she was joking with me or coincidence or if she actually did see something like that. But anyway, that's my faith story. And like I said, it's always stuck with me over the years. My name's April and my number's...
Man.
Wow.
I don't think it's coincidence. Like, what's the odds of you asking your grandmother that and she immediately going to... a little man.
Well, what I liked about the fact is that the grandmother says, you mean the one that drives the stagecoach?
Yeah.
But whenever she saw him, he's driving a car. So it's almost like it follows their age bracket as he changes.
Right. And we've talked about other sightings before where people have seen them in little airplanes mm-hmm. in a garden and stuff.
Yeah.
I love those stories. So bizarre. Thank you so much for sending that in.
That's
April.
Greatness.
Like I said, if you want to send your story in via telephone, the number is 888-393-BRUD or 2783. That's 888-393-2783. Or you can email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. I love the stories of the Fae, but I love the stories of Bigfoot.
Yes.
As well. This is a topic that we get asked constantly. It's most people's favorite cryptid. Even if it's not your favorite, it's definitely the one that's talked about the most. There's probably been more television shows done on Bigfoot. And today we're going to have on three guys talking about their new podcast called Sasquatch Tracks. That is Micah Hanks, Dakota Waddell, and Jeff Smith. Now, most of you, if you've been following Expanded Perspectives, are familiar with Micah Hanks. He's a brud. He's a good friend of ours. He's the host of several podcasts, including the Micah Hanks Program, formerly the Graylin Report, also Middle Theory, Seven Ages Audio Journal, and, of course, Sasquatch Tracks. He's also written lots of books, like The Ghost Rockets. I'm trying to think of some of his books. Magic Mysticism and the Molecule and the UFO Singularity. And it's a pretty interesting show if you're into Sasquatch. I know they just started just a couple months ago, but they've already had on several impressive guests like Peter Burns and Jeff Meldrum.
Yeah.
So if you like that kind of thing and you're into Bigfoot, stick around and check out our interview with them.
Yeah, I guess we could keep diving in, but I don't want to keep holding them up. So look, let's just jump into this. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, you'll get to hear the interview. And I really think you're going to enjoy it, folks. So stay tuned. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
All right, everybody. We got an important and very interesting show today. We have three gentlemen on. One of them has been on with us multiple times, but we got two new guys. I'm talking about Micah Hanks, Dakota Waddell, and Jeff Smith. These are the boys from the Sasquatch Tracks podcast. We're going to have them on to talk about some stuff today. How are you doing, guys?
Hanging in there. How you guys doing, my brud?
We're doing excellent. I'm very excited that you guys have started this podcast because this is probably everybody's favorite cryptid. We get more questions about Sasquatch than probably anything else emailed to our show. So I'd like it when there's new shows that appear that are exploring the topic from a different direction. And I've checked out your show, and I think others should, too. It's pretty interesting. Tell me what made you decide to start this podcast? What got you interested in stuff like that?
Well, you know, first and foremost, Brud, we should go into the long and sordid history of how we all know each other, right?
Sure, sure.
Any proper history. You know, Cam and Kyle, you guys reached out to me, I think. How long ago was it now? I mean, it's been
I can years. Tell you how long ago it was. Last weekend was 7 years.
That
7 years when we started. So it was almost, all jokes aside, we probably reached out to you 7 years ago from right now, from probably this day.
That is crazy. You know, I mean, and it's funny because we were out on the porch earlier before we got on the call with you guys, and Dakota said, where have the years gone? Because we were talking about Phyllis Galdi of Fate. And, you know, Phyllis lives right down here, literally about two mountains over from me. She moved right down here. She lives just over the way, and she brought the whole Fate farm with her, all the dogs, all the chickens, everything. But that was just a few years ago when we three were jumping in I was on a plane first, and then I came over to you guys' place, and then we jumped in a car and rode up to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, where Phyllis was there and a lot of other fine folks, Stephanie Mack, Hobbo. Yeah, so it's, again, every time we get to talk, it's kind of like a reunion. But, yeah, we've known each other for a while, and, you know, I keep tabs at all times on what's happening down there at Skeleton Studios with my broods. So, as you guys know, I think last time I was down there with you and we were all in studio together, it was a cryptid round table. We had Nick Redfern, we had Lyle Blackburn, you guys, myself, and it was just a great conversation. And yeah, like you mentioned, everybody's favorite subject, it seems, is Sasquatch. That's absolutely no exaggeration. And, you know, for a long time, I've wanted to kind of do a spinoff podcast from my main show. You know, I've got the Micah Hanks program, formerly the Graylian Report, of many years. And I enjoy that Sasquatch topic so much that I wanted to do a whole separate show. Now, little known fact, although longtime, you know, subscribers to my my main podcasts, the X shows, will know this. You know, Dakota and I actually began doing a supplemental show years ago called Crypto X. You know, it was just us once a month. We'd get on the mic, we'd riff on, you know, our favorite cryptids and stuff. Just had a great time with all that. And I think maybe, what was it? It was, I guess, around the time of the second George Norrie event here in Asheville, you and I were talking, Dakota, and, you know, saying we ought to try and get that show or some iteration of it going again, you know?
Yeah, and we talked about it for a while, and I don't know, we just, we tried to stay on top of it, and it just didn't feel like the right time, and then
something was missing.
Yeah, I ended up, about 2 years ago, I decided to go back to our local community college, and that's where I started doing the surveying program and got into it. And I met Jeff through that program, and just, I guess, just kismet, maybe, like we were talking and he said, oh, yeah, I know this guy, Micah. I've listened to his podcast on and off for years when you were still at the military base in Florida.
I was living on Navarre Beach, which right now is under a couple of feet of water. My house, you know, everything that's in the garage, I'm sure, is ruined. But I would run up and down the beach listening to podcasts, and Micah's was one of them that I would listen to.
That's
and
crazy.
So it was just out of the blue. Now, I retired from the Air Force, and I had it in my mind I wanted to study land surveying, but it needed to be a place where we're close to family, and Asheville happens to be centrally located to all of our different family that's in the area. So I'm in class, and we're out running a level loop or something for class one day, and he mentions, so yeah, my friend Micah. I'm like, you talking about Micah Hanks? He's like, yeah. So that's crazy. I had no idea that I would ever be in the bunker with Micah and, you know, meet Dakota as well. Yeah. A couple of really good friends.
And here you is right now.
I'm right here.
And it just kind of turned out that it was the puzzle pieces that we needed. The timing was right. I mean, hell, Micah and I've been talking Bigfoot and paranormal. I mean, since we were both in high school.
Yes.
You were into it before, but when I started playing in like a little garage band with your brother in like middle school, that's when we met. And very soon after that, you had let me borrow the Bigfoot True Story of Apes in America book.
By Lauren Coleman.
Lauren Coleman.
Cam, you especially will appreciate this. This kid, we could have called him String Bean. He was skinny and 14 years old with a bass guitar and shows up at my house. I'm like, who is this? And then I heard him lay down that funky rhythm and I was like, ooh, I know who you are. I'll never forget you. Yeah, but little did I know, he also was interested in this subject. And yeah, he was fresh out, maybe still in high school. I think you might have just graduated the first time we jumped in I think it was like a BMW with Sage Ledford and drove to Newcomerstown, Ohio and went to the Bigfoot event up there. And I wasn't even legal drinking age, ladies and gents.
I bet that didn't stop you.
Yeah. But no, we met Daniel Perez and Rick Fisher, I think, was there that year, and a few others. It was a really interesting experience to be able to go up there and to attend a conference. That was probably one of the very first conferences on this subject I ever, you know, went to. And so there, Dakota and I were together, you know, staying in a Super 8 hotel on the edge of town, you know. And talking about Bigfoot the whole way there and back. And Brian, our friend that went with us, is probably like, what are these guys talking about?
So, if you remember, he actually, I believe, fell asleep in the middle of the conference.
Yeah, he wasn't as into it as Dakota and I were. But anyway, so long story short, that brings us back up to the present. You know, this has been something we've been involved with for a very long time. And in fact, A lot of folks have said to me in recent years, they're like, you know, we would love, Micah, to see you more involved in Sasquatch research. And we mentioned Phyllis Galdi and Fate earlier. Again, I have to point out to folks, if you go all the way back to 2004, the October issue of Fate, the very first article by yours truly that ever appeared in print was actually about Sasquatch. And so, yeah, I actually got started in this. It's actually kind of been more like coming home rather than getting into something new. And a lot of people aren't aware of that about my own interest in this subject. So, but again, every time I come down to Texas, it's the same thing. It seems to be the one key topic we all like to geek out on, isn't it?
Well, I know that you and I sat outside of Mr. Filson's garage one evening and had a few wobbly pops. And we talked at length about missing people in Bigfoot in particular, and went on and on and on about that. And then Jeff brings up Navarre Beach. I've actually been there and stayed on that beach for a week and fished off of there. So I hate to see it that it's flooded.
It's a beautiful place, beautiful place.
Yeah.
We just beach people. And this is one of the reasons why every year May rolls around. You're like, okay, when's it coming? You just got to be ready for it.
Yeah. So were you into Bigfoot even though you were in Florida? Like, was there any skunk ape activity that got you wrapped up in this whole thing too?
No, I'm late to the game when it comes to that. I mean, when I was younger, there were more like one of the first books I remember reading that was more kind of, I'm going to say, supernatural oriented. It was this Time Life Mysteries of the Unexplained. And that had, you know, ran the gamut of all kind of weird and crazy things that happen. And the thing that caught my attention back then was more of like the demon possession, that kind of stuff. And that really freaked me out. You know, I had sleep paralysis for weeks, nightmares and stuff. It was awful, 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 awful. And I wasn't really deep into the cryptozoology until I was actually serving as a military attaché in Poland for 3 years, and I came back and got my first iPhone. This is about 2014. And that's when I first got into podcasts, and it kind of opened my eyes. Like, wow, there's a whole world of all these people talking about these interesting things that I like. And, you know, my Air Force career was winding down. I'm like, I'm going to start spending some more time, you know, researching things that I enjoy more than, you know, trying to stay on top of navigational regs and stuff like that.
And demons. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I just stay far away from that stuff. Yeah. So I started listening to podcasts and getting more and more into it. And maybe not, I'm not a believer. You know, I can't say I'm 100%. I believe that there is Sasquatch, but I certainly believe there's a possibility that it's out there. And that's why I wanted to do this with these guys, is to learn more about it, to actually go out and research and try to find out the truth of it for myself.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. Again, a lot of folks are like, well, come on, you know, we just take for granted that, yeah, Sasquatch is out there. He exists. Well, yeah, maybe. I mean, there's some very compelling evidence of the anecdotal variety, but again, you bring that before any scientist and say, come on, guys, there's got to be something to it. And no matter how many stories and no matter how good those stories are, you know, the physical scientist says, well, show me the body, show me the evidence. Where can I extract the DNA from? You know, where's the hair sample that we can conclusively analyze? And that's the really frustrating thing about this. And in truth, one of the things I think that draws all of us, Dakota, Jeff, and I think all have this in common. We're interested in trying to approach the subject of Sasquatch as a definite maybe, but one that we can absolutely no question apply good citizen science to. And so the approach that we take largely is trying to look at the subject, you know, and tell the stories and do the interviews and have the conversations about the subject that we all love, but also always in the back of our mind have, how can science better be applied toward this? Because if there's a real flesh and blood biological entity out there, this is something that we think not only should be studied, but it's also going to be something that is of great importance to science if it can be proven to exist. And if we are able to prove it and study whatever these species are, it may tell us something about what it means to be human. I mean, arguably, it could be the greatest single scientific discovery of all time. And yet, it's very interesting that science generally does not pay much attention to this because Sasquatch has been relegated to the subject of myth. And I wanted to quote Linnaeus, you know, the father of taxonomy, in a little-known document that was titled, I believe, Anthropomorpha. He had actually said, and this was actually from a dialogue that he gave to one of his students, but he'd actually said, is it not amazing that man, endowed by nature with curiosity, has left the troglodytes in the dark and did not want to investigate the creatures that resemble him to such a high degree? Now, that's a very little known quote from Linnaeus. And of course, in his taxonomies that he first introduced in the, you know, 1700s, he had argued that there were more than one kind of human. This, of course, is disputed, and almost immediately after Linnaeus brought the idea to the table, it was disputed. But he said, not only do we have Homo sapiens, you know, the thinking man, but we also have Homo ferus, the wild man, and then Homo troglodytus. And he was trying to make the delineation between the different kinds of people that he had encountered in travelers' tales from around the world, the kinds of stories that largely are dismissed as simply being that, you know, travelers' tales by today's standards. Some look back, though, to Linnaeus's writings and say, you know, maybe he wasn't completely off base in his theorizing that maybe there were different classes of humans. Now, certain classes we can now recognize, of course, as, you know, some of the higher primates and the like. Again, it was less well known at that time, and it would be still, you know, several decades, maybe centuries, in fact, before we would come to a full understanding that Linnaeus didn't have at the time that he introduced these taxons. But again, the fundamental idea that he introduced, that maybe there were other creatures like humans, is something that I think what we would call, rather than cryptozoologists, the proponents of what Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum advances as relict hominoids. He wasn't the first to use that terminology, but he certainly has popularized it in recent years. The idea that some relic species, something akin to an archaic human type, but which has persisted into modern times, and which may not be exactly a human or a hominin or human-like, but is something generally human in shape, a hominoid. The idea of the relict hominoid, maybe Linnaeus wasn't all that far off base, and if indeed there is some water to this theory, the way that he phrased it, it almost haunts me. Again, why has modern man, why has science left these species, for lack of a better term, in the dark? Why don't we want to investigate the creatures that resemble us to such a high degree? And although we don't have that physical evidence, sure enough, we do have those stories, and the stories that make up the body of the literature, they certainly convey that there's something very human-like out there.
Well, you touching on the idea of why they've left them in the dark brings me to the question that I would like to ask each one of you and go around the horn. You're talking about wanting to get proof. Or I would like to know each one of you's stance on, are you a kill Bigfoot or a no-kill Bigfoot? Which one are you? Which camp are each one of you in?
That's a good question.
That is a good question. Yeah, I've thought a lot about this. There's just so many stories and tales that you hear. I read one the other day. It was concerning the Momo incident back in the early 70s. And there's just so many stories of, you know, I had a gun, I saw this thing, you know, I had a bead on him, but then I couldn't shoot him because he was too he was too much like a man. It would feel murderous. And I would love to have the body. I personally don't really want to be the guy that pulls the trigger by any means, but you know, there has to be some sort of physical evidence. And yeah, I mean, a body would be great. But you know, there's an argument too that if Sasquatch and Sasquatch-like creatures are real, you know, is there a breeding population of these things? I mean, what if, you know, you shoot one of the last one of them? You know, so there's just a lot of open-ended questions of that. So I guess to vaguely answer your question, I want a body. I just don't want to produce that body myself unless, you know, I happen to be driving through the Redwoods and hit it with a station wagon like you would.
It was an accident.
Hell yeah. Well, yeah, we'll tie him to the roof and hope he wakes up at the
Harry
house.
Harry and the Henderson style, like super sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, everybody knows, you know, that is the Sasquatch's silver bullet is actually a Pontiac station wagon.
Yeah. Same as white-tailed deer.
Yeah. They have that in common.
Yeah. They have the same eye shine. Whenever you hit them with headlights, they freeze.
Oh, we'll get to eye shine.
So are all of you on the same page?
Yeah, what is Jeff's opinion?
Jeff, what do you think?
Yeah, I would say I'm on the same page. Obviously, to satisfy science, you would need to have a body. But like Dakota said, I don't want to be the one that harvests that specimen. Like I said, I want to know the truth of it for myself. I don't necessarily want to prove it to everybody. You know, if I see one, I'm fine with that.
Yeah. As far as I go, and this may surprise people, but I am no kill. I am no kill. And I'll tell you why I'm no kill. It's not because I don't think that we need a physical specimen, but intellectually and philosophically and maybe morally, again, my deep reading on the history that I believe comprises the, because again, this is an argument that many skeptics advance these days. This is a modern phenomena, they say. This all began, as far as Bigfoot goes, in 1958. It was all a hoax that was proven in 2002 when Ray Wallace's family came forward. And the proponents are going to have to eventually warm up to that and get over the fact that it's all shown demonstrably to be a hoax. Well, actually, it hasn't been shown to be a hoax. One simple question one might ask is, what inspired Ray Wallace to perpetrate the hoax in the first place? And we can get into that a little later. But again, my general contention would be that he, like many others and other hoaxers before him, had been well aware of the existing traditions of large human-like entities in the Pacific Northwest. And something that often is also dismissed or is challenged is the notion that indigenous American traditions bespeak an existing knowledge of these things. In fact, they did. I think that that is clearly not only something that is true, but it can be yet again proven. We can get into that later. But again, if you look at the history, if you look at the cultural narratives that existed well before Europeans arrived in the New World, and if we look at what this seems to convey about these creatures, my fundamental premise is that they seem to be human or very close to it. And again, if morally speaking, we can justify killing one of these things for science, and yet we can still also say that we think that they are human, or worse, we may not be sure, and yet we're nonetheless willing to kill them, that's a tremendous problem for me, because any good hunter, of course, knows fundamentally you do two things. You always identify your quarry before you shoot, and you always identify your backstop. You know, so a good hunter, I'm often confronted with that question of, you know, come on, these guys who say that they saw it, they had it in the crosshairs and they couldn't pull the trigger. Well, the reason I think that they say that, if indeed their stories are true, is because what they saw looked so human that they, and many will say this, I was afraid I would commit murder. So if we're talking about something that is human or nearly human, we have an obvious problem with trying to just kill one of these things in cold blood. And so for my own part, I can't say that that's morally justifiable. But then if you add to that the fact that with modern science, with all of the technology at our disposal these days, you know, with FLIR technology and with drones, with tranquilizer guns, you can't tell me that with the technology that we now have at our disposal, that there couldn't be a better game plan put into effect that would allow for the capture or at very least recording and maybe even retrieval of a physical specimen without having to kill one. The same could not have been said just a few decades ago. But it is incumbent upon us to use the best technology we have. And I think that now we have gotten to a point where it is more realistic to say we don't have to kill one. So I'm no kill.
Wouldn't the same argument, though, be used in the fact that if you're going to talk about a hunter, you also have to be aware of conservationists, which are environmentalists that carry a gun. That's what a conservationist truly is. And he, in turn, understands that sometimes you have to basically get rid of one, or you have to donate one in order to take care of the whole herd. So using that, if you can't get science to take it serious without a body, then you can't get the use of FLIR. You can't get the use of satellite. You can't get the use of drones, of helicopters. So that argument alone would still stand, that you would have to take a specimen in order for it to be taken seriously, whether it's agreed to be upon murder because it looks human, is still murder. It doesn't matter if you kill a bug, if you kill a deer, or you kill a Bigfoot, you're still killing something. Yeah. Looks aside mean nothing. It is what it is. You're not killing a human being who we have done. You're killing something that is arguably non-existent until you bring that body in.
That's true. And again, I also recognize, while as a personal moral stance, I don't advocate killing, I also recognize that, again, biologists, they're going to have to see that body.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't say that others shouldn't try that. And in fact, if you look at groups like the North American Wood Ape Conservancy, mm-hmm. they actually proceed with that very approach. You know, we are prepared to harvest one, but then we should advocate once we have the body, and it is absolutely unquestionable, it should be made a law that it is, it is illegal to kill one of these species. So they can't be protected if they don't exist, but they're not going to be recognized until a body is harvested. My personal philosophical view is that there may be better ways to prove that with the modern technology at our disposal. And you can call me unrealistic. I know many would, but that's my personal viewpoint. But I'm not going to stand in the way of others who think that there's a better way to do it in that traditional sense. And you're right, Cam. There's an argument to be made there. There certainly is. But I would maintain also that that was the only argument several decades ago, I think that the new technology at our disposal may have changed that argument or made it more nuanced today.
I still don't. I still am in the camp that it's going to have a body, but I too am not sure that I would want to be the fella.
No, look at all the blowback they got from Cecil the Lion. Can you imagine?
Well, yeah.
Sasquatch.
Cecil the Sasquatch? Yeah, well, it wouldn't go over well.
The tragedy would be we've finally proven that the creature exists, and somebody who did have the guts or whatever else it took to pull that trigger, what would happen to them? You know, now the NAWAC organization, you know, again, I don't agree with all of their perspectives, but I respect what they do and why they do it. And we've had this conversation a lot. I've actually got dear friends who are members of that organization, full disclosure. So, I mean, you know, again, I obviously am well aware of what they do. And I have to have respect for people who are willing enough to say, let's get out there and let's do this the only way that time has ever proven reliably we can establish the physical existence of this species. You know, I wouldn't want to do it that way. And I'm with you there, Cam. I recognize this conundrum and how challenging it is. But I think where we all seem to agree, and again, make no mistake, I understand why the necessity exists for having the specimen. But like all of us so far who have spoken, with the exception of you, Filson, I want to hear from you too. But I mean, but again, none of us seem to want to be the one that pulls the trigger. Think what would happen to the person who does. They would be castigated. It would be all over social media. Mm-hmm. In this modern environment, it would be politicized. That person's life would be over, at least in terms of being able to enjoy and live comfortably, because they would be given literal hell.
Yeah, I'd have to be in the no-kill camp as well, or they'd be canceling my show like they tried to do with Ellen. You know, I'm very happy with this podcast. I wouldn't want to do anything else, but Bigfoot in general, this has got to be one of the most frustrating subjects for me. I want to ask you guys, because when I was little, I remember the first time I'd even heard about such a thing was like a episode of In Search Of was on, and they were talking about the, you know, the miners in the cabin there in Ape Canyon that were getting bombarded with rocks. And I was like, what are they talking about? And I remember there was a school library that had a book in there about Bigfoot. So I became interested as a very young child. But over the years, the older I've gotten, and now with the start and creation of our show, I've had hundreds of people ask me over the time, like, do you believe that Bigfoot's real or whatever? And honestly, my mind changes from day to day. We talk about it on the show all the time. It depends on what day of the week you ask me, because I will definitely see some footage, or I will hear a story from a listener or someone that I meet and I'm 100% convinced. But then like the next week you could ask me the same question and I'd be like, man, there's no way. How can it be? How come no one's found anything? I want to know, what makes you guys think that Sasquatch is a real thing? Is there a particular sighting? Is there a particular video? Is there a particular case that is solidified in your mind? I know earlier, Micah, you kind of mentioned eyeshine, and that's an important part of every sighting, is people talk about having eyeshine when most great apes, much like humans, don't have eyeshine. Are there any particular cases or videos or stories that someone has shared with you that's made you 100% convinced, or are you on the fence like me, depending on which day of the week you are asked?
Well, if you guys don't mind, I'll jump in really quickly and just say, I mean, yeah, I am just like you, Kyle, because I'll study the modern accounts in, you know, the Pacific Northwest, and I'll think, gosh, you know, there is quite clearly something to this. But then when I go back in time and I start looking at what might be historical accounts, you know, from antiquity to the present, because again, we have to recognize that if these creatures exist in North America, logic would dictate that they, like other species, including, you know, modern humans, likely came into North America toward the end of the Pleistocene from another portion of the world. And so it holds that not only might there still also in other parts of the world be similar creatures, but further that, again, if they exist today, they would had to have existed throughout history, and therefore there should be historical accounts that exist in the various parts of the world where there are indigenous traditions involving so-called wild men. Again, they couldn't exist today and have only just recently become, you know, an existent species. They have to have been here all along. And so that's been something I've really worked at. But if you, again, looking throughout history and trying to find good historical evidence, and in fact, there is a lot more than people are aware of. This is a project I'm working on right now. I can't say too much about that, but yeah, there's going to be a writing project that will, I think, establish a much deeper history for the purported existence of relict hominoids. But even despite my interest in trying to establish that history, guys, when I look at these stories and I look at the way that there are such consistencies between cultures, and in fact, not just in the descriptions of the alleged animals, but in the cultural narratives involving them.
Right. Right.
Yeah. On the worst day of the week, you know, or maybe the best day of the week, I wake up and I'm like, you know, these are archetypes. This is the archetypal wild man. And just like sociologists and social scientists would say, you know, the anthropologist who looks at it and says, you know, guys, this is something that we need, like Carl Jung would call it, the shadow. You know, this mm-hmm. is some extension of the darker side of the human psyche. Yeah. Certain days of the week, I could absolutely say that's really all this is. And then I hear those reports from the Forest Service worker, you know, the retired right. Park Service, you know, ranger, the police officer mm-hmm. who says, you know, it was 10:30 p.m. Pacific time. The thing was in the headlights of my vehicle. It raised one arm to cover its eyes. I got out of my car and began to draw my weapon because I thought it was a person until I realized it wasn't wearing clothing. It was covered in hair and it was 10 feet tall. And there are reports like that. Now, it's not to say that a police officer might not also be a liar from time to time, but, you know, look, again, we have heard the same story, the guys and I, from police officers, from pastors, you know, from the best and the worst among us in our society. And at some point you have to say, if all of these people are liars, then we have a whole different, very paranormal phenomena that we need to study. And it has nothing to do with a shaggy beast that walks on two legs. It has to do with trying to understand how humans just can't tell the truth. Because our world is absolutely flooded with pathological liars or people who are hallucinating. And so, you know, again, on those other days of the week, I'm like, there's no way there couldn't be substance to these stories, with or without a body. But now, coming back to your main question, as far as the thing that really says to me, look, this could be it, and this is maybe some of the best evidence we have. I go back to 1967, Bluff Creek and the Patterson-Gimlin film, and not just what's in that film, mind you, but also the footprints. Initially, you know, there were two castings made by Roger Patterson himself. And only a couple of days later, we also had Bob Titmuss go back out to the site, and he made castings of the footprints, which were still there. And in fact, I think it had been Gimlin who had gone back and covered some of the spoor that had been left by the purported creature with bark, I think, because that's all he had on hand. But I mean, it had begun to really rain that weekend that he and Roger were there. And so they covered some of the footprints to preserve them. By the time Bob Titmuss, the other Bob makes casts. And then they were also photographed by a third individual, Lyle Laverty, who was a Forest Service worker who later went on to actually hold a position in the Bush W administration. But Lyle Laverty also photographed the track line. Now, the film is interesting, but it was really doing a deep dive into those footprints. And then, of course, talking with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum of Idaho State University about those footprints and the story that they convey. And again, I have looked at that now and said, you know, the film is interesting, but man, the footprints. And actually speaking with a professor of anatomy and anthropology who has studied more ancient human footprints from around the world, like the Laetoli Trackway. You know, I think there's a volcanic park in Hawaii that they also found human footprints from about 1,000 years ago that he studied as well. But again, when I speak with Meldrum about the footprints, and then you correlate what the footprints talk about. And again, his position is that there's toe displacement, there's a mid-tarsal break. There are all of these elements that could not have even been known by a hoaxer at that time. And yet all of these very key distinguishing elements are present in the trackway left by the creature. You add to that what you see in that film, and I would say it's hard for me to look at that film and say this is a guy in a monkey suit. You see the muscle tone moving beneath the hair. You see the physiological characteristics. And then the skeptics would say, yeah, but, you know, Philip Morris said that it was his suit and that he sold one to Roger Patterson. What people never, ever talk about is the fact that Philip Morris, when he actually watched the film, said, yeah, well, I'm pretty sure that's my suit, but the face is all wrong and the arms are too long. They must have made some sort of a different kind of a mask because that's definitely not the mask I sold Roger. Again, the long story short is he did apparently sell a suit to Roger Patterson, but when he saw the film, he said, that doesn't look like the suit. You know, that's not everything that I sold him. They must have augmented the suit. And so the skeptical argument isn't as rock solid as many have tried to make it out to be. When I look at that film and I consider that trackway that was also left at the site, I'm like, look, if this isn't a Sasquatch, I don't know what is.
Well, I have the same thing watching that film. I've watched it 100 times and I can watch it one day and I'm like, dude, that's real. And then there'll be other days that I'm looking at it. And I'm like, man, I don't know. And I know people have brought up the fact that Patterson was a known con artist and things like that. But my argument to that is just because someone's a con artist or somebody that may be kind of shady doesn't mean that they didn't have an encounter. Like, you can be a liar and still have an encounter. And so that's not good enough proof for me. I'm with you in the fact that why are there so many sightings all over the world, whether you're talking about Almaty, Urine, I'm trying to think of some of the some of the crazy names, the Yowie, you know, they got names everywhere. All the people, all these cultures, all are having the same sighting. They're all making it up. It just seems awfully odd to me. And I've often wondered if some of the earlier cases, like Albert Ostman stories and things like that, that maybe Bigfoot was alive and well back then, but now no longer exists. I don't know. But as far as what is Jeff, what are you and Dakota's opinion? Is there any particular cases that forced you to shift your mind one way or the other?
No, I can't point at anyone in particular. Yeah, I've listened to so many of them on, you know, various podcasts and different books that I've started reading. And it always brings my mind back to Hebrews. I don't know if you guys are, you know, read the Bible much, but Hebrews 12, you know, it talks about, you know, we're surrounded with such a great cloud of witnesses. Now, obviously, they were talking about Jesus there, but all these other stories are talking about Bigfoot, Sasquatch. And like you mentioned, there are traditions in multiple continents about this. And so that's incredibly compelling. Obviously, Patterson Gimlin, I'm not going to get into the film anymore. Micah's laid a pretty good case out on that. But I will say, you know, as a layman looking at it, yeah, it's still pretty compelling. But when you hear the experts, you know, when you hear Dr. Meldrum talk about the foot physiology and the movements and the way the legs, the gait, yeah, all that combined, it's pretty heavy evidence. And then also, I've got an uncle, Munkle Darrell's, I like to call him. He lives up in Washington State. He's been a wildlife biologist pretty much his whole life since he got out of the Army after Vietnam. And he's had some experiences. Now, he hasn't seen a Sasquatch, but he's had some seen some other things. And you know, he's someone I trust. And I do remember, gosh, this is probably back in 1984. I remember him and my father having a conversation and my uncle talking about finding hair in a part of the woods and looking at it. And it, you know, knowing that he is a wildlife, he's a large carnivore specialist and he works with, you know, not just Washington State, but he works all over the West with their conservation efforts for large carnivores. So all kinds of bears, wolves, coyotes, cougars, you name it. He's very smart on the subject. And so he's someone I trust who's had his own experiences and that, you know, lends more credence to it as well.
Yeah. Cam loves those cougars, by the way.
Yeah. You got to keep your eyes on them all the time.
And cougars will get you in the doghouse if you ain't careful.
Got to always be watching.
For me, you know, Micah and I've looked at the folklore aspect of it from, you know, indigenous cultures, First Nation cultures forever. And, you know, they're worldwide. Like we were just talking, how many different names can you sit here and think of that from different cultures around the entire world? You know, something we talk about a lot is like, you know, just pull out a map sometime from the Southeast or actually all of the United States, probably anywhere. And you see a lot of these different place names like Booger Hollow and stuff like that. Now, those may have been created, you know, as a safeguard against someone going in there and, you know, falling off a cliff or something. But there's this idea of just these. The point is they're all across the entire world. You know, one thing I've really been into lately that's kind of changed, not really my perspective, but just kind of made me think about it a lot more, as I've been a lot into, and we've talked a lot about the Florida cases and, you know, having Lyle on last week, I've been kind of deep in Falk and just the similarities, but differences. So you look at that kind of like divergent evolution or adaptation between the Sasquatch of the Pacific Northwest as compared to the United States. So, you know, I've just been thinking, kind of trying to open my get outside of the box, if you will, to think about, like, well, you know, like the three-toed tracks, for instance. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
you see a lot of those in the Southeast that you don't see in the Pacific Northwest. And it's like, well, are these fake or is this an adaptation? If they are an adaptation, if this is a biological entity, why three toes as opposed to five?
And does that suggest that there's more than one species that we're talking about, you know?
Right. And is it a separate species or is it just an environmental adaptation or even a mutation or something like that? So, I've just been really been digging a lot of the sightings outside of the Pacific Northwest right now, just to kind of give myself a different perspective of it.
Well, Smokey, you'd appreciate this. When I was a kid, you know, I was interested in two things, blues music and Sasquatch. And when I was a kid, I thought I had to go all the way to Chicago to find the blues. And little did I know it was actually right in the South, you know, where I lived. I thought the same thing about Sasquatch. I'd read Peter Burns' books, you know, and I'd read Ivan Sanderson and thought that, you know, if even we could suspend our disbelief enough to think that there could be an actual species like this, you got to go up there to the Pacific Northwest to find it. And then you begin to, again, I'll resort to the history here for a moment, because I've been plowing through Chad Arment's book, Historical Bigfoot, which, by the way, the second edition, more than 1,000 pages. This guy, he got a newspapers.com account and went nuts or something like that, because, I mean, he found every account that you can imagine. Some of these date all the way back to the 1700s. Now, Jeff right here in studio has another book that my wonderful assistant Lauren sent along. It's David Pilatus's Bigfoot, Wild Men, and Giants, which, you know, it's a little more cut and dry kind of version. David actually, rather than taking the time to type up all the reports like Chad Arment did, you know, David puts the actual newspaper clippings, which is also valuable, in this book. And his actually go even further back than some of the ones that Chad Arment found, and they're not exclusive just to North America. So both of those books are very, very valuable. But what they will show you is that even if you don't buy the idea of there being a flesh and blood creature, there is not only, at very least, the idea of this so-called wild man, and often they're referred to more explicitly as ape men, giants, gorillas, etc. But this idea has been with us much longer. It's not something that began in 1955. That whole reductionist skeptical attitude really gets on my nerves. And it seems to show that, well, they don't, those who would make that argument, don't seem to know about the history. But again, a further review of the history also shows that it is not necessarily geographically located explicitly in the Pacific Northwest. So very much like the blues music that I found right where I live as a kid, there are actually a lot of stories from the Southeast, especially in the area of Florida with its tradition of the skunk ape, that seem to describe a similar creature. Whether it is the same thing as the Pacific Northwestern variety is another question, because there are some notable differences in the descriptions.
Yeah, and I think you're 100% right with that, because it makes sense from a biologic standpoint. In other words, I'm trying to think of a good analogy. Like deer. So deer in Texas or South Texas are completely different than deer, say, up in Illinois.
Yeah.
And deer in Florida are going to be completely different than deer up in Alberta. You know, whether it's elk, whether it's coos deer, mule deer, whitetail deer, they're all deer. They're all under the deer family, but they're different based on the region that they live in. So it makes perfect sense to me that a swamp ape down in the Everglades would be different in height, and maybe the toe arrangement, things like that would be completely different than something that lived in the Himalayas. And yeah, like you talked about, there were sightings, you know, before 1955, speaking of the Himalayas, like Eric Shipton. In 1951, you know, the iconic photo of the Yeti footprint.
I still don't know what to make of that. I mean, but it looks like a primate footprint, and it seems to, you know, Dakota, you talking about the three-toed foot, the Shipton footprint's really interesting in that regard, because you've got three little toes that are little phalanges off to the side, and then you've got what might be almost like an index finger, but then you've got what seems like a distinctive hallux, like a thumb-like toe. Yeah, people try to say, now here's the thing. You guys being hunters probably are like me. You're fascinated with tracking. And of course, I've studied more man tracking. I have no actual qualifications or certification. It's just something I've read a lot about. I own Albert Taylor's book. And, you know, what really got me interested in that, of course, was the search for the missing boy from back in the 1960s in Cades Cove, Dennis Lloyd Martin, who vanished. I have been involved in, you know, filing Freedom of Information Act requests about that to so many different agencies over the years. including a actual appeal process to the FBI to try and get them to release the file that they have on that. But the long story short is, I don't equate that story with Sasquatch in any way. However, it absolutely got me interested in man tracking and in studying, you know, how you find a path that, you know, whether it's a human or an animal, what it, you know, how you track that, you know, creature, that specimen. And when you look at the Shipton photograph, you know, I've seen yet again the skeptical argument that, well, you know, what's probably happened there is this was a mountain lion, and through the successive, you know, freezing at night and then the thawing in the daytime and then in the freezing again at night, it expands and it gets, you know, a little less defined with every passing day. By the time Shipton et al. came upon that footprint, it had already gone through several successive, you know, melts and refreezes, and that's probably what you're seeing. Well, again, with the modicum of tracking information, you know, at my disposal, I can see in that photograph what appear to be very distinctive, clear-cut, sharp edges.
Right.
The contour and the contrast is very distinctive. It seems to me that that is a photograph that is actually depicting a fairly fresh footprint. I don't see evidence of melt and thaw in that. I see what appears to be a very primate-like footprint with all of the distinctive characteristics in terms of tracking of a fresh footprint, too, that hasn't had time to go through melting and refreezing. So, you know, I don't know what that is or what the animal is that left it, but I know a couple of things that other people who have found similar footprints in the Himalayas describe, not just a single footprint out there in the snow, but a whole trackway, and they say that whatever the animal was that left them was bipedal.
That's right. And then the locals, whether it's the Sherpas or just the people in the area, they have a word for what it is. They believe it. They've had multiple people that have cited such a thing. I think it's wrong, and I don't know why we do this. We always seems to like dismiss native folklore or native legend, and because we're civilized, we don't believe that they know what they're talking about. But I mean, they have a history of such a creature, and then there's the footprints in the snow. Why do we assume that it's not that? Exactly what they say it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'll just interject here that, again, you know, yes, among the Sherpa, you know, the idea of the Metokangmi, you know, yes, very much a tradition. But, you know, if we jump back across the Bering Strait and over into the Pacific Northwest again, it's interesting because I've seen the argument made that to try and say that indigenous American traditions in any way are related to the modern idea of Bigfoot is at its worst a misunderstanding, or it's at its best, let's say, a misunderstanding, and at its worst, it's a kind of, you know, paternalism. In other words, we'll tell you what your legends mean.
Yeah.
Quite the contrary, though. I recall, again, J.W. Burns writing about at the Sasquatch Days Festival, you know, some of the townsfolk getting up there and saying, we've always been interested in the indigenous legends. And one of the tribal leaders got up and grabbed the microphone and said, no, these aren't legends. These are our stories. These creatures exist. You know, it's you people, you white men that always try to tell us what our legends mean. And again, I'm quoting him from the parlance of the day. But, you know, I've never understood that attitude that the indigenous American traditions cannot and do not represent what we recognize as Sasquatch. And if I may, I'll try to briefly kind of give you my rationale for how we can actually prove that. Interestingly, we have prior to, again, J.W. Burns in 1929, he first introduces the term Sasquatch, which is an anglicized word borrowed from the Halkomelem language. Sasket or something along those lines would have been more, you know, a close approximation to the actual indigenous word. But he anglicized that and we had Sasquatch. Now, of course, prior to 1929, when he wrote his first article in Maclean's magazine, introducing British Columbia's hairy apes, or I'm sorry, hairy giants was the term he used, we didn't have the word Sasquatch. But if we go back to 1924, of course, at Mount St. Helens, we had a group of miners who claimed that they were attacked by 7 to 8 foot tall hairy ape men.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite stories.
The famous Ape Canyon incident. At the time that the Associated Press reported on that, they interviewed a man by the name of Yostotsji, and he was a Clallam tribe leader and sort of a historian. And he said, the Clallam have known these creatures that the miners describe for generations. We haven't heard of them or seen them in 15 years at least, but he says, we recognize these as the Siatik. The Siatik are covered about the body in hair like a bear. They're 7 to 8 feet tall. Some say that they actually have a language. And he, you know, very explicitly said, that's what these miners are describing seeing. Now, interestingly, the ethnologist and he was actually one of the first to go to California and to the Pacific Northwest and to study indigenous languages in depth. But George Gibbs, the ethnologist, had written about in an entry in a dictionary of the Nisqually language. He had actually had a very brief entry for the Siatic. I think he actually wrote a variant of that, though, Siat Ko. And he described them as a kind of spirit that haunts fishing grounds, which are also believed in some of the indigenous traditions to kidnap women and children. What is not as well known is the fact that there was also an original manuscript that Gibbs wrote, and which actually the Oregon Historical Society had been writing about as early as maybe 1955. It came into their possession in 1949, but there was an excluded portion of the original manuscript where Gibbs went much more into depth into all of the traditions, and he gives a much more lengthy and detailed description of the Siat Ko. And in that description, dating back to around maybe 1865, if memory serves, George Gibbs says, you know, again, they believe in a variety of creature which infest the earth, which it's hard for me not to think actually represent a real race or tribe. They're 7 to 8 feet tall. They're covered in black hair or dark hair. They look almost like a bear, the way that the hair covers their body. They steal salmon from men's nets. They're terrified of these creatures. They communicate with whistle sounds in the woods. You know, if one's seen or believed to be approaching, many of the tribesmen will run to their homes. The point I'm making is that Gibbs actually did record by the middle 19th century the Siatic traditions, which were again echoed by Mr. Totsjee in 1924 when he explicitly said that's what the miners are describing up there at Mount St. Helens. And it wasn't for another 6 years until, I'm sorry, 5 years actually, in 1929, when J.W. Burns first uses the term Sasquatch, which became the most widely recognized name for the creatures in the Pacific Northwest and abroad, until, of course, Ray Wallace began hoaxing footprints in late 1957. But then when Jerry Crew discovered some of those footprints in 1958, you know, the press picked up the story and started calling it Bigfoot. But yeah, I mean, again, you can make explicit connections between indigenous traditional names and beliefs and the information that was recorded by early ethnologists like Gibbs and later accounts that were provided by tribal leaders as early as the 1920s. So again, you know, to say that this, you know, this idea, their traditions, their mythology has nothing to do with the modern Bigfoot, it's nonsense. They describe the same thing, and you can make clear associations between the names and the uses and appearances of those names over the decades.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, we've talked about it before on our show, me and Cam. You know, if someone was to come here, say, visiting from Ireland or whatever, and an armadillo walked through the backyard, they would probably lose their mind and freak out. Like, what is that? Is that really an armadillo? And to me, because I'm from here, I see them all the time. So it's not something that I would feel like, okay, when you guys first arrived, check this out. I got to show you the armadillos. I think it's like that when those areas to the natives, Sasquatch or whatever they call it, it's a known thing. They've grown up since a child knowing it's there, maybe even if it's seldom seen, but they know about it through legends and things. And so they don't really think about it as being a big deal, where to us as outsiders, it seems very strange and exciting. You know, that's what and it angers me when people go anywhere, no matter it's the South American jungles or where, or the Congo in Africa, and they dismiss people's stories because they somehow feel like they're inferior to them, so their stories cannot be legit.
Yeah, I think something else too, you know, just being in America, or even, you know, the European mindset, however you want to look at it, we're so easy when it comes to dismissing indigenous cultures or First Nation stories. I think growing up in a westernized world, it's kind of hard for a lot of people to understand like the polytheistic kind of cultures. So Native Americans having, you know, the animal spirits and such that they talk about, like growing up in a Judeo-Christian world, like we're in America, like we're kind of, you know, taught to almost think that's nonsense or, you know, verboten, if you will. So I think that's one way that we, you know, have become dismissive and just don't open our minds up to that when they're like, no, this is part of our culture. This isn't just a tale that we have come up with. So
it's also a bit of like fear of the other, you know, I mean, and it's again, like you're saying, Kyle, I couldn't imagine a greater travesty than to march proudly into, you know, as we did again, you know, you guys have had me on the show in the past with my colleagues, Jason Pintrell and James Waldo, when we're discussing, you know, North American archaeology. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we have taken great pains to try and convey with the Seven Ages Project is, you know, a profound respect and an understanding that we must have for indigenous Americans and traditional beliefs. And also, again, this all predicated on the fact that, you know, effectively toward the end of the 15th century, Europeans showed up and we just helped ourselves. And, you know, that's an uncomfortable thing for a lot of people to deal with today. But I mean, there are still efforts toward reconciliation with that and recompense for that that are underway in modern times. And I think maybe sometimes the best thing we can do is we can understand our history and we can try to interpret stories and understand stories in the original context in which they were presented rather than, oh, here's what that actually means. And so I'm with you, Kyle. I get really angry when I see this, you know, this wonderful modern materialist Western mindset. We're going to march proudly in here and tell you what your stories actually mean. No. You know, allow for them to be interpreted in the proper context, which can only be the context in which they first originated.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, I've actually been on an expedition with you. This was before the podcast. Me and you and Cam and Lyle Blackburn. Actually, he gave us a tour of where the Lake Worth Monster sighting took place. You remember that?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that was a bit of an expedition. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the early stories from the 70s. Of a Sasquatch like creature that, you know, runs up and down the creeks. I remember hearing about that as a child. I'm very interested in your show. I like the fact that you're approaching this subject. I'm glad that the three of you are tackling that. Can you tell our listeners where they can find Sasquatch tracks, how to follow you guys, and if, what you guys are going to be working on in the next 6 months to a year?
Absolutely. Yeah, my man. And again, it's always great to get on here with my broods. I hope sincerely though, that Kyle will be able to get back down there to Texas because y'all make a mean steak. And I still got my red Chuck Taylors that Cam gave me the last time I was down there. Yeah, baby, I got them. Although I might have to loan them to my brother because I hear he's dressing up as the Noid for Halloween and he needs some.
Oh, some wow. I've so been avoiding the Noid since like 89.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Right? So I told my mom, though, I said, Mom, I'll pay you. I just need you to make me a green Noid costume so I can go be the antagonist, you know, and give Caleb a hard time. But anyway, no, you can find our podcast at SasquatchTracks.com. And of course, it's on Apple Podcasts and probably available by now where all fine podcasts can be found. But if there is a podcast player that you prefer and you can't find it there, let us know. And we will try and get that on there for you. But again, we do the podcast, you know, one to two episodes usually per month. Mm-hmm. And we have featured some very interesting interviews, in my opinion, including, again, the first book probably on this subject I ever read was by Peter Byrne. I think he just turned 95, mm-hmm. and he is still with us. He is up there in Oregon, and Peter Byrne joined us for the second episode. And again, you talk about an epic conversation to talk with this guy whose writings I have pored over for years. And Pete's, you know, he's not so skeptical that he doesn't think the creatures exist, but I mean, he will tell you, you know, flat down, you know, I've never found, the way he words it is there is no evidence. There is no physical evidence that proves that these things exist. Now he has found some footprints and things himself and he still thinks that they're out there. But I mean, I like that he, after doing this for decades, he's in his 90s and he's still going out there and, you know, interviewing witnesses and occasionally will actually go to these sites. He's very, you know, in great shape, you know, for his age. And he has never come away from the idea that the creature could be there, but he definitely balances it with some skeptical, you know, tendencies. And I like that about Pete. So anyway, we had that conversation with Peter Byrne. We had a two-parter with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum, where we went deeper, I think, on the subject with him than really anybody has. Because you often hear people talk with him about Sasquatch, but we get into paleoanthropology. We got into ichnotaxons. And if you don't know what that is, you got to listen to the episode to find out. He explains it. In fact, he introduced the ichnotaxon for the American Sasquatch, gave it a name based on the footprints. So, you know, we've got some very unique content and some very different kinds of approaches that the guys and I've been taking with our interviews. Lyle Blackburn was on there with us the other night. We got a lot more good stuff in store, and we definitely think people will be interested in the citizen science applications for the study of relict hominoids.
Yeah, very exciting. Dakota or Jeff, tell people how to get in touch with you. You got any Instagram or Twitter you want to promote?
Well, we have the Sasquatch Tracks Instagram. My own Instagram is just Hieroklas, HIEROKLAS. And then we also have, you know, our Twitter. Personally, though, if you want to contact me, it would be Jeff@SasquatchTracks.com. Similarly, it would be Dakota, or actually be Smokey.
Smokey. Smokey@SasquatchTracks.com. That's S-M-O-K-Y, no E.
That's right. Yeah.
And then I'm on Instagram. My handle's Clawhoss. That's C-L-A-W-H-O-S-S. So that was a fun – that comes from my old banjo playing days. So.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, a lot of your listeners already know who I am and what I do. I've been involved in podcasting and research and travel and, you know, all kinds of stuff for a long time. SasquatchTracks.com is this podcast. Everything that I do can be found at MicahHanks.com. And if you just go to MicahHanks.com/shows, you've got all the shows right there, including Sasquatch Tracks. You can get it that way too. So yeah, definitely check us out. And you know, Cam and Kyle, my brothers, you're always such wonderful hosts. Thank you for having us. Again, I hope next time I get to talk to you guys. I'm sure one of you are going to call me first, but eventually soon, I hope we all get to break bread in these crazy times. It's been way too long. I can't wait to see you again.
Yeah. We'll get down there and we'll go armadillo catching.
Yeah, let's do.
Yeah, let's do it. Sounds like an excellent time. Glad to have all three over.
Yeah.
And we are back.
Okay.
That was, look, anytime we have Micah on and all the guys, Micah could go on for hours. Like the dude, yeah. Look, I don't know how he keeps up with all of it, but he really does. He's one of those guys you can tell sits around and thinks deeply about a lot of this stuff.
Well, and like during the interview, like I'm completely honest and have been following the show for a long time. You know, I say that all the time. It depends on when you ask me. There are days that I'm like, there's no way Sasquatch is real. It's impossible. We would have found bones by now. Somebody would have shot one by now. I spend an awful lot amount of time in the woods. I've never seen anything like that. And then there's days where I'm like, dude, it's got to be real. Why do so many people from so many cultures from different parts of the globe all tell a similar story? I've personally met people in person who have told me their sightings. I mentioned it before on the show. I know an old farmer. Old rancher who doesn't even know that, you know, that I have a podcast. He doesn't know anything like that, but he mentioned to it me one day that he saw something that looked like a Bigfoot. Now, why would he just come up with that? And I mean, lots of people have told me at conferences and things, similar stories. You said you've hunted with guys who have told similar stories. So I'm not any closer in knowing. And I know you out there listening and watching, you don't have any idea either. But if you're interested in Sasquatch and topics like that, you need to go check out their podcast, Sasquatch Tracks. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I enjoy it. I enjoy those guys. They seem to be pretty well researched.
Well, and I know that we even discussed, and it's a very sensitive topic when you talk about should you kill one.
Right, yeah.
But we've always said, and to be honest, the only way that this is going to ever be settled is with a specimen. So something has to lose its life.
I agree.
It's the only way. I don't really see. I mean, I guess you could capture one, but do you want to put one in a cage? You know, like I don't know how that would go. So I mean, I'm torn with the whole idea, but I do know as a conservationist that in order for this to take place, in order for you to protect the many, one has to be taken.
And not only, I'm completely unsure if it exists or not. Like I said, it depends on what day you ask me. But I'm also, I don't know if I want it discovered because then the mystery's gone. I kind of like the mystery. That's what makes it fun is you read these stories. You're like, man, is that real? What could that person possibly see? Can you imagine camping?
I don't want it to be discovered.
You know what I mean? Once it's known, then you're like, oh, well. Yeah.
I don't want it to be discovered because I want it to, that mystery to always be there. I just like it. I like that teaser, the idea of there's tracks or there's a little hair or there's a crazy howl or
that it's associated with UFOs and orbs and it's ultra dimensional and it's the ghost of a Neanderthal. It's not physical.
I like those
the
angles.
Intrigue. That's me. Yeah. It's like never meet one of your heroes, right? Because you'll be disappointed. I think it's kind of like that.
I think you're on to something there. Yeah. I don't know. I like the mystery. All of y'all watching and listening right now, you know it's the same thing. You like the mystery. That's why you're here. And so I think that's – I'd like to just leave it at that.
Right? And if you have a Bigfoot or Sasquatch encounter of your own that you would like to share with us, please email or call the show. You can email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call – the phone line, 888-393-BRUD, or that's 888-393-2783. Cam, what do you got planned for the rest of your week?
Hard work and clean living, like I always talk about. I really don't know. This is going to be the first weekend in a while that I don't really have anything planned in stone. So I may have, this weekend may be nice. I've got my mowing done. I've got a bunch of my honeydews around the house done. So I think it's going to be a pretty good just – even keeled, everything's nice. As you can already tell and you can hear, apparently I'm highly allergic to ragweed and had no idea. And all that came in. And so all these years of me doing this podcast and y'all hearing us sniffling and coughing down here from our allergies, I found out that mine's ragweed and that it will quickly develop into a serious case in your chest if you just don't do anything about it.
Well, I got bad news for you. I saw the meteorologist talking about another wave of it coming in next week. And pollen.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go get something. I don't even know what to do about it. That being, if any of y'all have any ideas how to combat this, let a homie know.
Holler at your boy. Yeah. I mean, look at the size of my nose. Yeah. I'm sniffing up all the pollen.
He's got it all. Well, at least out of one side. The other side's been broke enough. I'm surprised it stays on your face.
Yeah.
But anyhow, so folks... yeah, that's it. If you got it, holler at one of us. Let us know how we can combat that stuff.
All right, man. That's about all the time we have for this episode of Expanded Perspectives. Till next week, all y'all be safe. Wear your mask, social distance. Till next time, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.